It's one thing to get the right to collectively bargain and another to actually get a contract. I'm David Brancaccio in New York. As we reported, workers at an Amazon warehouse in Staten Island voted to unionize on Friday, the first successful union drive at the second largest private employer in the U.S. Amazon invested heavily in its effort to stop this from happening, but there is much more work to do before workers are paid under a union-negotiated contract. For more, let's bring in Adam Seth Litwin. He's a professor of industrial and labor relations at Cornell University. Good morning.
Good morning, David.
Looking at Staten Island, flash in the pan, a one-off, what do you think?
Well, on the one hand, it's just another data point that shows workers are actually gaining some real power. We've seen walkouts from healthcare workers and teachers, service workers, and we've seen successful strikes at Volvo and John Deere and Kellogg's. But at the same time, labor organizers hope, and I think employers really fear, that what happened on Staten Island was just the camel's nose under the tent. And I think that it may well be. So headlines like Staten Island from last week, I think they promote unionization in a way that no celebrity and no politician really can. JFK 8, that plant where they had the vote, it has over 8,000 workers. It serves as a central node for East Coast distribution. So the Amazon labor union, they didn't shoot the beast's forearm. They hit it squarely between the eyes.
Yeah, and Amazon worked to stop this. I mean, it invested, I think, one estimate about $4 million in getting consultants to see if they could get the workers to see it differently.
And that's what's so amazing, is that they managed against the odds to really make this happen. I mean, since the pandemic, we've seen lots of evidence that workers are finally securing a larger slice of the pie than they've been able to secure in a long time. But here's the thing. Without collective bargaining, all of these gains that have been afforded by economic conditions, they're going to evaporate even more quickly than they materialized. So if unions can actually manage to organize during this period, then workers can actually protect, hold on to, and maybe even build all the gains that they've been able to make right now.
You've seen that one of the features of the Amazon workforce in these warehouses is a very high turnover rate. Does that make it even more surprising to you that this particular union in this warehouse was able to get this result?
So now that they've been able to certify, in some sense, the real fun begins, because about half of successful union certifications never reach a first contract, despite the fact that labor is really trying. What employers typically do is they try to delay for about a year, and then they try to seek union decertification. And the reason they're able to do that in a case like this is because turnover is so high. Most of these workers will not have even been there when the union was able to secure this vote. And so Amazon can look at them and say, hey, listen, you've had a union for a whole year and they've done nothing for you. That's going to be the real challenge moving forward.
You know, you've heard the song, New York, New York. If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. To some extent, is what happened on Staten Island a special case?
Yeah, I think it is. It shows that grassroots local organizing efforts, I think, have a real advantage over the more conventional top-down approach that we typically see. The Amazon labor union, they understood local issues at work and in people's lives. They knew how to speak to workers. And I think by doing that, they really robbed Amazon of one of its best anti-union arguments, the idea that these carpetbaggers don't know you, they don't know us, and they've come from far away just to collect your union dues.
Adam Seth Litwin is a professor of industrial and labor relations at Cornell. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Meanwhile, Howard Schultz is back in the CEO chair today at Starbucks, where some workers are also embracing unions. Schultz has halted the buying back of company stock to prop up prices, to use the money to improve working conditions and to revamp the company. The stock is down 4% now. And you know how Tesla CEO Elon Musk is often Twitter's best friend when he uses the platform to send trolly tweets? It's revealed today Musk has become Twitter's biggest shareholder, 9% of the stock he owns, news that has Twitter stock up 21% this morning. And here's a number, $2 trillion. Trillion. That's how much climate change could cost the federal budget 78 years from now, every year by century's end, given new migrants fleeing climate hardship, flood, fire, storms. The White House had asked its Office of Management and Budget for a best estimate. That's $2 trillion in current dollars, a total that represents 40% of last year's total federal budget.
Thank you.
Most days we take the economic pulse from a variety of perspectives. To start the week, we consult economist Julia Coronado at Macro Policy Perspectives. Good morning.
Good morning.
The person nominated to be vice chair of the Fed, powerful position, Lael Brainard, is giving a speech tomorrow in Minneapolis, and she's going to touch on inflation and its effect on inequality. That's an important issue, right? It affects people differently and can widen the gap between rich and poor.
Yes, and it's especially relevant when we're talking about the inflation related to the war in Ukraine, which is going to be focused in energy and food prices. And that's where lower-income consumers spend a much larger share of their budget on those items, and so it will hit them hardest.
And the rip-roaring debate continues among experts, economists, and others trying to figure out how long this period of inflation will stay with us. And I know the Fed is doing its darndest to tamp it down with its policy.
It definitely is, and we are going to probably be at 5% mortgage rates this week or next week, so that ought to at least take some steam out of a very hot housing market.
Julia Coronado, economist, founder of Macro Policy Perspectives. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
The Marketplace Morning Report, Economic Pulse, regular checkups from a range of perspectives. I'm David Brancaccio. And we're from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.